The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Syria is in chaos. Old enemies have joined together to fight their current common enemies. Some Kurds say everything they fought years for is disappearing in an instant.
Many sons and daughters of us have martyred and give their blood for this territories, but everything is going to go just like that.
Also today, the writer Salman Rushdie applies his literary intellect to reality TV.
I think of the Real Housewives, the ones from Atlanta are the most enjoyable.
Yeah, I want you to be happy. Thank you.
All in the name of research. And some Iowa farmers are fed up with Trump's trade wars.
The first thing that's going to get hurt is agriculture. That's just, you look back at the past and that's how it is. However, we're tired of being pawns now.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The turmoil and chaos in northern Syria is growing deeper. To complicate matters, President Trump says he's going to sanction Turkey's aggression in northern Syria. It is confusing, and we'll explain more in a moment. But we wanted to focus first on the people affected, people like Rojane Werger. She's a resident of the town of Sarakaniya in the Kurdish region of northern Syria. After she heard that Turkish soldiers were on the way to her town, she escaped as bombs were falling to another Syrian town nearby, Al-Hasaka. Werger feels trapped. That's because Syrian troops are now also coming to her region.
It is really disappointing, and we are really angry and really sad about this fact, but there is no choice but that. So if this is going to stop the blood that is shedding, we are okay with that. But many sons and daughters of us have martyred and give their blood for this territories. Everything is going to go just like that. It is really sad and really disappointing.
What were you hoping for?
I was hoping, just like everyone, we were hoping to have our own country, our own life, our own freedom, our own rights.
I gather, though, some of the people from your town held celebrations this weekend, apparently when they heard Syrian soldiers were on their way. What were the celebrations about?
Some people who are staying in Al-Hasaka, who really wanted the Syrian military to come back, they were celebrating. We could hear firecrackers till 1 a.m. They were happy that they are getting rid of the bombardments. They are getting rid of Turkey and Erdogan. So that's why they were celebrating. But not the Kurds. They weren't waiting for the Syrian regime to come back.
In terms of the fighting that's been going on for the last few days, I understand that you lost someone pretty close to you, a friend of the family?
Yeah, he was a fighter, and he has martyred in Sarakaniya.
Rojane, you've seen this kind of attack on Kurds before. I know you're 24 now, but when you were 16, you had to flee another Turkish incursion into Syria. What is different this time, though?
The first time the bombardments started, I went to my room and started collecting my books so I can go and study. We were allowed to cross the borders at that time. This time, when the bombardments started, I was in the middle of my room looking around, and I couldn't bear it to start collecting everything again. So I just took some money and my certificates of the university. And that's it. I couldn't take anything, even though I had clothes. I couldn't take anything. So I thought it was just useless. We feel helpless. We feel like the time has stopped. Nothing is going to change.
Rojane, when I asked you earlier what you were hoping for, you said, for the Kurds, our own country, our own rights. And yet that homeland has always been so elusive. Do you still have hopes that the Kurds can have a homeland?
I was talking with my friend a moment ago, and she was really disappointed and sad and asked me if we're ever going to go back to Sarikani. I told her something. I said that if no one supports us, the whole world, our land, won't accept any traitors. Our land won't be a traitor for us.
The whole world may be full of traitors, but not your homeland.
It won't accept anyone but us. We are going to go back to our homeland because that soil isn't a traitor. It only will accept us.
Rojin Werger, thank you very much. Good luck to you.
You're welcome.
Rojin Werger, a resident of Sarakaniya, a town in northern Syria that the Turkish military bombed last week. She fled to nearby Al-Hasaka, Syria, which is where she spoke with us from. It is a very confusing scene in northern Syria. Lots of players, lots of objectives. Old enemies forming new alliances to face off against greater enemies. The World's Chris Wolf is here to help us make sense of all of this. So what is going on? Because it's pretty darn confusing.
Yeah, it is, Marco. And I think one of the main reasons is that there are so many players. But let me try to break it down for you. On the one side, you've got Turkey, a nation state moving into northern Syria to try and quell what it says is a threat to its own national security, a Kurdish autonomous zone. Alongside the Turks, there are Syrians who are mostly jihadis who've been enlisted by the Turks over the last years to fight for them. So they're doing a lot of the fighting for the Turks, and they're fighting the Kurdish-led alliance in northern Syria that's been running its own affairs for several years with the backing of the US until last week. And the Kurdish-led alliance is called the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. They're not just Kurds. They have a lot of Syrian Arab allies. So it's a Kurdish-led alliance. And I spoke with Thomas McClure, a spokesman for the Rojava Information Center, a Kurdish research and advocacy group in northeast Syria this morning.
So the situation right now on the ground is extremely chaotic, to put it mildly. Turkey and its the jihadist factions that it's using as its ground troops primarily have redoubled their efforts, perhaps in the understanding that there may be some kind of agreement coming to be reached, wanting to advance as fast and as hard as they can.
So you have the Turks on one side and their allies against the Kurds and their allies on the other side. Those are the primary players in the fight at the moment. But as that spokesman was just alluding to, it's about to get a lot more complicated.
Yeah, more complicated because of that agreement, that deal that that spokesman for the Kurds just mentioned. What's that about?
Well, yes. So the Syrian Democratic Forces were pretty much an American creation. And up until now, they've largely depended heavily on the American military for their security. They were the ones, though, who did most of the fighting against ISIS. So when President Trump decided to pull out U.S. troops from the region last Sunday, the Kurdish-led alliance was helpless in the face of this attack from Turkey. So the SDF yesterday made a new military alliance. Now, this one is with its former enemy, the government of Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian regime. And I heard from Kurdish spokesman Lokman Ehme. So he's stressing that this is purely a military alliance, not a political one. He hopes that the Kurds will retain political control of their autonomous zone, although experts I've spoken to are pretty concerned that it's unsustainable. Now, the Kurds made this deal with the devil because they say they want to save as many of their people as possible and as much of their territory.
What, though, has kind of practically changed as a result of this alliance between the SDF and the government of Assad?
So Assad's forces have pretty much become a third player in this fight. As soon as the deal was signed yesterday, Assad's forces immediately pushed forward into the Kurdish autonomous zone. And as we speak, are facing off with the Turks on a number of locations. So there's no reports yet of any hostilities between the Turks and Assad's forces. It seems that Assad, as you know, is backed mainly by Russia and Iran. And it seems the Russians are trying to mediate to avoid any clashes between Assad's forces and the Turks, and also with any of the remaining U.S. forces in the region.
Yeah, speaking of those remaining U.S. forces in the region, where are they in all of this chaos?
Well, President Trump has this afternoon confirmed an order to evacuate all the remaining U.S. troops out of northern and eastern Syria. There will be a small post maintained in the south of the country, but that's on a different, unrelated mission. But in effect, the mission to help the SDF and the Kurds is over. However, that's so much easier said than done, because you have the situation now where several hundred of America's finest special forces are scattered around a war zone in small groups and under orders to get themselves out. And remember, they have no friends left amongst the warring parties there. President Trump, for his part this afternoon, also condemned the Turkish incursion and announced he would be imposing sanctions against current and former officials of the Turkish government. And he said, quote, "I am fully prepared to destroy Turkey's economy if Turkish leaders continue down this dangerous and destructive path." But it must be said, Marco, that the president's tweets and comments about Turkey and Syria today contain many false and misleading statements.
Finally, what is happening with ISIS? Because we see reports of ISIS supporters or fighters escaping from detention.
They're definitely back and out in the open, thanks to the chaos unleashed by this invasion. They're now, in effect, the fourth major player in this fight. The area occupied by the SDF, as you may well know, was the heart of the ISIS caliphate with its capital at Raqqa. ISIS sleeper cells appear now to have been activated and are carrying out attacks, including bombings and assassinations. Thomas McClure of the Rojava Information Center in Qamishli in northeast Syria added this detail.
Here in Qamishli, what was my favorite falafel shop was targeted by ISIS in a double car bombing. As a result of that, four civilians lost their lives.
Experts that I've spoken to say the conflict has definitely a shot in the arm for the Islamic State.
The world's Chris Wolfe. Thank you for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
The final Nobel Prize of the year was announced this morning in Stockholm, this time in the field of economics.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has today decided to award the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel to Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo, and Michael Kramer for their experimental approach to alleviating global poverty.
The trio came from MIT and Harvard. The economists attack social problems on alleviating poverty, almost like doctors testing out a new drug. The world's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
In the mid-1990s, Michael Kramer had what you'd call an aha moment. He was working with a nonprofit organization in Kenya distributing free textbooks to kids. And there are programs like this all over the world. The theory is you give kids resources and school attendance will go up. So Kramer's friend, who was running the program, was just supposed to start handing out the textbooks. But Michael Kramer had a different idea. Here he is speaking about it in 2014.
I mentioned to Paul that if they wanted to understand the impact of their program, they could find 14 schools and start the program initially in 7 of them. Choose those randomly.
Kramer designed a large randomized trial, like a drug trial. He gave some kids the treatment, in other words, the textbooks, and some kids were in the control group, so they got nothing. And in the end, what he found surprised everyone. The kids who got the textbooks didn't do any better in school than the kids who didn't get the books. What was effective? Giving the kids pills to cure their intestinal worms. Again, using randomized trials, Kramer found that a health intervention cut school absence rates by 25%. Esther Duflo worked with Michael Kramer and also won a Nobel today.
So these are not your intuition. This is not what people would have gone for. And yet these are the programs that work.
In her TED Talk in 2010, Duflo explained that the World Bank, NGOs, governments, private donors, they all give billions of dollars to helping the poor. But too often they go from fad to fad and have no idea what works.
The thing is, if we don't know whether we are doing any good, we are not any better than the medieval doctors and their leeches.
She says we're no better than medieval doctors using leeches.
Sometimes the patient gets better, sometimes the patient dies. Is it the leeches? Is it something else? We don't know.
Duflo says that randomization, like in the Kenya example, takes the guesswork out of the process. But not everyone is convinced that it's the answer. Michael Patton is a well-known consultant in international development. He was interviewed on this program back in 2007 for a story about Duflo, Banerjee, and Kramer's work. Patton says randomized trials are harder than they look.
Community interventions cannot be reduced to the control conditions of laboratory experiments, which is what the medical and pharmaceutical model is about. The complexity is so by a hundredfold different from administering a pill that the comparison actually breaks down.
And what works in one country can't necessarily be exported to another country. So back to the textbook deworming example. Just because something works for 30,000 students in Kenya doesn't mean it will work for the millions of students in other parts of the world. but the Nobel Committee has endorsed the work of the three economists. In announcing the prize, the committee said, in just two decades, the laureates have, quote, considerably improved our ability to fight global poverty. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. For nearly 2 weeks, the capital of Ecuador, Quito, has been in turmoil. Protests broke out over the price of fuel. The administration of President Lenin Moreno had announced it was getting rid of government subsidies on gas and diesel. That sent fuel prices soaring. Indigenous leaders said they were and would continue to be the most impacted, so they took to the streets. They blocked roads, set fires, and clashed with police. The protests brought the city and much of Ecuador to a standstill. Businesses shut down. Oil production was cut big time. The violence even forced President Moreno to relocate his government from the capital to a coastal city some 400 miles away. Then, late last night, after hours of televised talks, the government and indigenous leaders struck a deal. Fuel subsidies will be restored. In return, indigenous leaders said they'd end the protests. Celebrations broke out in Quito and across the country. The indigenous community won the battle, but now comes the hard part, finding the money to pay for the subsidies. Ecuador originally agreed to slash its spending on fuel as part of a loan deal with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. Now the government will need to come up with new ways to tighten the budget. It'll work on that with indigenous groups. Last night they agreed to form a new commission to forge a path forward.
Para que de forma inmediata empiecen a trabajar.
In a televised address, President Moreno said he wants whatever they come up with to put less of a burden on those struggling economically in Ecuador. Quite a change from last week. In Guatemala, a high-stakes drama and some high-profile falls from grace have been unfolding over the past year. At the center of the action is an international anti-corruption commission. The commission has taken down many of the country's elite, including a former president and vice president. Emily Green begins her report in the remote Guatemalan village of Pitahaya.
El perdón de Dios es maravilloso.
At a tiny church, a dozen people sing songs praising God. Most of them grew up in the village. Life here isn't easy. Basic necessities, like putting food on the table, are a daily struggle, says Reina Maria Ramirez. As God knows, some days we eat and some days we don't. That's how we go through life, she says. Life has been especially hard in recent years because of drought. This year, the harvest dried up. Ramirez says the government doesn't help.
Nos piden fotocopias. Las fotocopias se van. Y ya en el, después no hay nada. Solo estamos y va a mandar papeles.
She says they're always asking for photocopies when she applies for government assistance. And then the photocopies disappear. Nothing changes. She says once she had to pay $6 to apply for a school scholarship for her son. She remembers because it's more money than her husband earns in a day picking coffee. The money vanished, and the scholarship never materialized. That's why we stopped believing the government. We've been cheated a lot, she says. And that's just the run-of-the-mill corruption. In 2014 and 15, Guatemala's Social Security Institute negotiated a lucrative contract with a pharmaceutical company in exchange for alleged financial kickbacks. The company provided faulty dialysis treatment. And at least 13 people died from kidney failure, according to prosecutors. Claudia Figueroa's mom died 68 days after starting treatment.
La corrupción provoca muerte, tristeza, hambre y dolor.
Corruption leads to death, sadness, hunger, and pain. And Figueroa says the scandal would have been buried if it hadn't been for an anti-corruption body known as the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala. For more than 10 years, the United Nations-backed group revealed extensive corruption within the government. Its work even led to the downfall of a former president. Most people here know the commission as CICIG.
La CICIG fue un elemento importantísimo en este caso.
CICIG was critical to our case. If it hadn't been for them, we never would have seen important officials held accountable for their actions. They gave us hope, Figueroa says. Lucrecia Hernandez Mack agrees. She's a congresswoman-elect and former health minister to President Jimmy Morales. When she first took that post, she realized the government hadn't purchased vaccines 2 years in a row. The funds had disappeared. And that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Food, health services, and cash transfers are basically not getting to the people that are supposed to get them.
People see the government as a vehicle for getting rich, she says. Politicians secure appointments for their friends and allies who support their campaigns.
So basically, there's like this big problem because institutions are not working for people. They are working for private interests.
Hernandez Mack only stayed at the Ministry of Health for a year. She quit when President Morales started to attack CSIG. The commission was investigating Morales and his family for allegedly accepting illegal campaign funds. In September 2017, Morales ordered CSIG's leader, Ivan Velasquez, expelled from the country. He's now in Colombia.
El hecho de haber descubierto tan fuertes redes de corrupción en el país.
The fact that we uncovered so many powerful networks of corruption and organized crime is a huge success, he says. But he says CSIG's high-profile battles created enemies of powerful businessmen and politicians. Guatemala's president sent lobbyists to D.C. to portray CSIG's director as a leftist determined to undermine Morales' conservative government. There were even allegations of meddling by the Kremlin. Russian businessman Igor Bitkov was convicted of buying fake Guatemalan passports for his family. He claims CSIG targeted him because it wanted to help Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Yo podría comparar CSIG con un perro de grande tamaño que no tiene dueño.
I would compare CSIG to a big dog that doesn't have an owner. It turned into a corrupt organization, he says. Last year, Guatemala's highest court overturned the conviction against Bitkov and ordered a retrial. In the U.S., which provided the majority of CSIG's funding, lawmakers took note. Florida Senator Marco Rubio temporarily blocked millions of dollars in U.S. funding for the commission. There's no legitimacy to the complaints, says Eric Olson, an expert on Central America at the Washington-based Wilson Center.
They stepped on toes. They created an environment in which the privileged did not feel very privileged any longer. So there are certainly a lot of aggrieved people, but there's no evidence that CSIG was corrupt.
But as CSIG's battles dragged on, U.S. support for the commission began to waver. In 2018, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations said CSIG should lower its profile, that it didn't need to be in the news every day. And when President Morales refused to extend the commission's mandate, the U.S. didn't intervene. In September, CSIG ceased to exist. And now that it's gone, the people it targeted want revenge. A group of Guatemalan politicians are seeking an investigation into the commission's employees. Guatemala's highest court has stopped that effort, for now. But the message is clear. If you go after corrupt officials, watch your back. For The World, Emily Green, Guatemala.
You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
About 2% of Israelis are originally from Ethiopia.
We are the only black in this country, and it is our children that suffer violent behavior from police.
Black Lives Matter in Israel. Also, Iowa farmers just want to sell corn, and they're tired of Trump's trade wars. That's all still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. For over a month, northeast Brazil has been in the middle of an environmental mystery. Thick, sludgy crude oil has been washing up on the beaches there, and no one knows why. The oil is keeping people away. It's also a big problem for Brazil's sea turtles. The World's Maria Elena Romero has been following this. So, Maria Elena, what is going on with the turtles in Brazil right now?
I've been talking with one of Brazil's oldest and most respected conservation organizations. They are called Projeto Tamar. What they do is to protect specific locations where the sea turtles go and lay their eggs. They go mark their nests, they monitor them, but the rest is left to nature. When the sea turtles are ready, they hatch and then they just walk into the sea. But this year, with the oil spill, biologists are concerned that this is going to affect the reproductive cycle of sea turtles.
So this group, Projeto Tamar, what are they doing differently this year?
They are actually taking the baby sea turtles into the open ocean to be released.
Mm, not leaving it up to nature.
Exactly. Vamos lá? This is actually a video that someone from Projeto Tamar sent me. On the boat, there are white plastic containers that have about 1,000 baby sea turtles. They are taking containers one by one and just dumping the sea turtles carefully into the water.
Wow.
The scene is beautiful, but this is actually unprecedented. In the 40 years this organization has been working, it is the first time that they do this. And they are only doing it because they want to protect the baby sea turtles from the oil.
Let's get back to the turtles in a moment. I want to talk about the oil right now. Where is it all coming from? What do authorities know so far?
Well, where is it coming from is actually the million-dollar question. The source of the oil remains a mystery. Several agencies of the Brazilian government, including the Brazilian Navy, they are doing basically detective work to find out where this oil came from. There are researchers working with computer models, putting historical data of ocean currents and winds just to pinpoint the origin of it. The Brazilian Navy is also looking into the shipping routes just to find, like, who could have done this.
So there's research going on, there's an investigation, but are there any theories about where this oil came from so far?
Yes. There have been studies done by Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, and a couple of independent labs in Brazil that concluded that this oil is crude oil that is not produced or commercialized in Brazil and that has the composition of oil that is produced in Venezuela. And they can say this because actually when they do the chemical analysis of it, each oil has a particular DNA, let's say.
Right.
So they can actually pinpoint like the exact location where this oil was taken from.
So a few theories there. Where are officials in Brazil with the cleanup of this sludge?
There are crews that respond to reports of presence of oil on beaches. They pick it up with shovels. They put it in big, white plastic bags. Actually, there's so much of it that some cities do not actually know what to do with it. This is affecting a very big area of Brazil. There are remote areas, some of them very important environmentally, that are not being cleaned because there is not enough people to do it.
Yeah, right. So that brings us back to the sea turtles. What's their situation right now as we speak?
Earlier, we heard this video of the biologist releasing the turtles into the ocean,
right.
And they sounded really joyful. But actually, there is a lot of uncertainty here. I spoke to Cesar Coelho. He's the sustainability director of Projeto Tamar, and he told me this was their last resort.
Ontem, levamos para offshore, para o mar aberto, para o alto mar, né?
He says that releasing the turtles into the open ocean is not a recommended practice. The sea turtles, when they hatch, they have to make their way into the sea on their own. This is called imprint, and that serves as a guide for that same animal 20 or 30 years later to come back to the same beach to lay her eggs. So scientists are not sure what the consequences of releasing them into the open ocean could be. But right now they have just very few options until the oil is cleaned up.
The World's Maria Elena Romero, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
The future for those turtles is uncertain, but that moment they were released, that was pure joy. We put the video on our Instagram for you. We are at PRI The World. This year's Booker Prize for Literature was awarded this evening in London and left the audience delighted and stunned.
Well, there is genuine shock in the room, I can tell you, because no one expected the judges to split the prize as much as anything, because the rules explicitly forbid it.
The joint winners are Bernardine Evaristo for her novel Girl, Woman, Other, and Margaret Atwood for The Testaments. It was Atwood's second win for the highest literary prize in the English language. Hoping for his second win tonight was Salman Rushdie. Sure, The Booker is a long way from reality television, but that's one of the themes of his nominated novel, Quixote. The story is about an American road trip based on Don Quixote with a heavy dose of reality TV. The BBC's Vincent Dowd has more.
Thank you guys so much for being here. I'm just so incredibly proud of...
Salman Rushdie is winner of a previous Booker Prize, of the 1993 Booker of Bookers Award, and the 2008 Best of Booker. But at home in Manhattan, he's been watching a lot of trash TV.
Shut it down.
It was all research in aid of his new 15th novel, Quixote.
Since I have a character whose mind is being poisoned by reality TV, I had to do my due diligence, so I actually did watch really upsetting quantities of Real Housewives and Kardashians and Bachelors and Bachelorettes. I think of the Real Housewives, the ones from Atlanta are the most enjoyable.
Now I want you to be happy.
Thank you.
I do not care.
All I'm saying is the joke in the spiritual temple.
It was not a joke.
The Booker-nominated Quixote tells a story based on Don Quixote. Sam Duchamp is a hack writer writing about Ismail Smile, or Quixote. He is an Indian-American pharmaceutical sales rep who falls in love with a TV star and drives across America to find her in New York, the city the authors called home for 20 years. So is Rushdie now a New Yorker or still, deep down, an Indian?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of us Indians in New York, you know. I've always identified with cities in a way more than with countries, you know, so I feel very much a sense of belonging in Bombay, which I still call that, and in London and in New York. They're all places where I feel I have very deep roots.
Were you trying to give a big, as it were, cinemascope picture of America?
It's interesting that you say cinemascope because I use that kind of film metaphor all the time to myself. Even while I was writing the previous novel, The Golden House, I was saying to myself, next time you have to get out of the 212 area code and explore this huge and varied and problematic country. Yes, the background is America as it is in this rather crazy moment. What I feel is that when reality becomes as strange as it has become, when it becomes a kind of unreality, you can't go on writing classically realist novels to describe a very unclassical and unrealist world.
Has the Trump era changed everything, really, for someone trying to write about America? Maybe not just about America, because you can no longer say, oh, nobody would say that or nobody would do that. It's just not a rational response anymore.
Well, it is, you know, what Quixote calls it, the age of anything can happen. And I do think that that has been unleashed upon us, truthfully, not only in America. Watching the Brexit meltdown from New York, I'm not sure which of our two countries is in worse shape. But certainly that moment of the most improbable things that you would never have dreamt of becoming almost everyday commonplace events is, I think, something that the UK and the US have in common right now.
Writer Salman Rushdie speaking with the BBC's Vincent Dowd. The U.S. and China have reached one of the biggest deals ever made, at least those are the words of President Trump. The two countries have come to what Trump is calling phase one of a trade deal. It's a verbal agreement at this point and seeks to strengthen protections for American intellectual property and give financial service companies more access to China. The president also said that China would be purchasing $40 to $50 billion worth of American agricultural products.
To show you how big that is, that would be 2.5-3 times what China had purchased at its highest point.
Joining me now is the world's Jason Margolis, who has been covering this trade war. So help us here, Jason. I see that last year China bought $9 billion of U.S. goods. The high bar was nearly $25 billion in 2014. So is this $50 billion that Trump is talking about the Chinese will buy now, is that for real?
Well, first of all, it's not as big of a deal as he claims. It would be about twice the high from 2014. And is it for real? People are very skeptical that that can be reached. First, there's the timing. When is that $50 billion going to be purchased? Is it coming right up? Is it next year? So if it's coming right up, well, harvest is going on right now. You got to get those soybeans and corn out of the ground and you got to get it over to China pretty quick. The other issue is that China has found new places to purchase their farm products like soybeans. They are buying from Brazil now during this tariff trade war. So are they going to then turn to their new Brazilian partners and say, thank you for getting us through this rough patch for 18 months and we're going back to the American farms? That's not the way business works. You find a new partner, you stick with them. So that $40 to $50 billion seems very ambitious.
So take away this $40 to $50 billion and China's going to buy it or not. Is this deal that Trump has been talking about, this verbal agreement, is it a breakthrough or is it hype at this point?
People are cautiously optimistic that something is happening. But even the Republican senators from Iowa, Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, they wanted more information before they could say, yes, this is a huge breakthrough. Those are his allies. Congresswoman from Iowa, Abby Finkauer, who is a Democrat, was vicious toward Trump. She said the president started this fire and he should not be taking a victory lap over putting only part of that fire out. The markets we took decades to build have been lost to countries like Brazil, as I was just saying. Mm. There's an economist, Derek Scissors, with the American Enterprise Institute, who we have on the show regularly, and he told the Washington Post, it's basically some purchases and a bunch of fluff. Overall, it's a very preliminary deal. The president does say there's phase two and possibly phase three coming, but it is far from the monumental deal that he has been promising us.
We know one group that's going to be watching all of this with a lot of interest, Midwestern farmers, and it's not just concerns about any deal with China. Amy Mayer with Harvest Public Media in Ames, Iowa, has been speaking with growers about how they're feeling about all the trade uncertainty.
Rod Pierce shows a group of Japanese visitors around his farm in Dallas County, Iowa. Harvest is coming, and the corn plants are taller than all the men. Pierce steps into a row, plucks an ear of corn, and breaks it open.
Ooh. Okay, see that light-colored area there? That tells how close it is to maturity.
Pierce is doing what he can to keep these Japanese buyers happy with his corn.
Do you guys have any problems with our corn as far as quality?
Tommy Hamamoto interprets.
They like corn with higher protein content.
So we need to know that and hopefully provide you with the higher protein type corn.
That's just one way Iowa farmers could make their corn more attractive to overseas buyers. But what they say they really need is better access. That could happen soon in Japan. The U.S. and Japan have signed a tentative trade deal, which would open up Japan to more American-grown wheat, pork, and beef. It's been a rare trade victory for the Trump administration. Iowa farmer Michael Fritch would like to see more of them to send his corn, soybeans, and beef overseas.
We are good at what we do. We produce good products, and the world knows it.
Fritch voted for Trump, in part because of Trump's stance on trade. Like Trump, Fritch saw China as a bad actor. Fritch liked that Trump promised to do something about that.
He offered a new plan.
But when Trump slapped tariffs on thousands of Chinese goods, China punched back, leaving Fritch and other farmers looking at a vastly smaller market for their exports to China. U.S. farmers are also struggling to sell more to the rest of Asia. Fritch wanted to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a multi-country trade deal which included access to Japan. It was negotiated by the Obama administration. U.S. farmers generally liked the trade deal, but President Trump prefers smaller deals like the one with Japan. And in his first days in office, Trump pulled out of the TPP.
It was very, very friendly. The more of those free trade agreements we get, the better agriculture does.
Trump has also thrown NAFTA, the trade deal with Mexico and Canada, into uncertainty. The administration revised the 25-year-old agreement, but that's now stuck in Congress, with Trump occasionally threatening to walk away from the deal entirely if he doesn't get his way. Taken all together, Fritch is getting fed up.
Anytime you have a trade situation, the first thing that's going to get hurt is agriculture. That's just, you look back at the past and that's how it is. However, we're tired of being pawns now.
For some Iowa farmers, though, all of these trade issues just aren't that big of a deal. George Naylor says nurturing international sales may be good for global agribusinesses, but not for actual farmers. Naylor says his prices remain largely stagnant. His expenses keep going up, and that's after decades of free trade deals promoted by commodity groups and corporations.
It wasn't too long before I recognized that what they were saying was nothing but propaganda.
Naylor says politics and policy are driving the price he gets for his crops, and one buyer in particular has too much influence.
So it's actually China that's determining the outcome of our farm economy by levying these tariffs and scaring the market.
So Naylor is looking for another path. He's transitioning his corn and soybeans to organic, which fetches a higher price, and would like to sell most of that domestically. He also added oats, hay, and apples to his enterprise. He hopes the diversity will make him less vulnerable to trade wars. But try as they might, most farmers can't escape this fact. We live in a global marketplace now. Across the Corn Belt, most farmers take their grain to the local elevator and accept the price on offer. They'll never know whether their corn is turned into domestic biofuels or fed to pigs in Japan. For The World, I'm Amy Mayer in Ames, Iowa.
Queen Elizabeth today delivered her highly anticipated address to the UK Parliament.
My government's priority has always been to secure the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union on the 31st of October.
The Queen's speech is a formal address written by the government, delivered by the Queen, and consumed by a public that is awaiting its Brexit fate this week. The next 5 days are big for Britain. We will know by this weekend whether a Brexit deal between the EU and the UK is in the offing or not. The Queen's speech today, merely the opening act. Stay with The World this week for the rest of all the drama. Last month, a kindergarten in southern Israel was shut down. The school was accused of segregating students by race. An Ethiopian Israeli mother posted on Facebook that the school had sent her daughter to a separate classroom, along with other children of Ethiopian descent. For the Ethiopian Jewish community, it was another painful reminder of its minority status in Israel. About 150,000 Ethiopian Jews live there. That's around 2% of the population. The World's Matthew Bell met a couple of rising political stars from Israel's growing Ethiopian population and has this report.
On the day that 38-year-old Gadi Yevarkin took the oath of office in the Israeli Knesset, he welcomed his mother to the ceremony at the parliament building by kneeling down and kissing her feet. It was a rare display of a traditional Ethiopian gesture of respect. I met Yevarkin in mid-September. He was speaking at a town hall meeting in a suburb of Tel Aviv called Or Yehuda. Almost everyone in the audience was Ethiopian, the men sitting on one side of the room and the women on the other. Yevarkin spoke mostly in Amharic, the official language of Ethiopia.
Hello.
Hello, hi.
Bro.
Yevarkin introduced himself to me as a Zionist, a proud Israeli, and a patriot. When speaking to Ethiopian voters, Yevarkin said the first issue he brings up is a difficult one. He talks about racial profiling by the police. It's a well-known problem in Israel, he said. And he says his job in the Knesset is to pass legislation to stop it. Over the summer, an off-duty Israeli cop shot and killed an Ethiopian teenager. It came after another fatal police shooting of a young Ethiopian man earlier in the year and sparked large protests by Ethiopians in several Israeli cities. Demonstrations blocked traffic on major roads and, on occasion, they got violent. Going into September's election, police brutality was a major concern for many Ethiopian voters. I spoke with Melazish Mangessa about it at the town hall meeting. They need to stop killing our kids, Mangessa told me. The officer who killed that teenager, she added, he is still at home. That case is still in court. But the cop is reportedly going to be charged with negligent homicide, which carries a maximum sentence of 3 years in prison. Mangessa said she hopes that Ethiopian lawmakers can make a difference. She's looking to Gadi Yevarkin and another Ethiopian politician, Penina Tamano-Shata, who was at that same town hall meeting. Like Yevarkin, Tamano-Shata was born in Ethiopia. She was 2 years old in 1985 when she arrived in Israel. She was part of a group of about 8,000 Ethiopian Jews brought to Israel by a military airlift called Operation Moses. They were refugees who'd fled famine and war in Ethiopia, ended up in displacement camps in Sudan, and then began new lives in Israel.
For us, Israel, the Holy Land, Jerusalem, is the home. Was a dream that come true.
Tamano-Shata has had quite the career path. After she finished her mandatory army service, she started off as a pop singer. Then she went to law school, and after graduation, she got into journalism. But even with her stellar resume, growing up as a new immigrant, as part of a small minority of Jewish Israelis who are black, Tamanos Shatta says she's been keenly aware of discrimination since she was a child. Deciding to run for parliament, she says, was her way of doing something about it.
I deal with a situation that I feel that there is a discrimination and racism, and I knew that I must do struggle against that, and not only me, but all the generation, the new generation that born and grew up in Israel. For us, it is very important to feel equal.
Tamanos Shatta was first elected to the Knesset in 2013. She's worked on access to education for Ethiopians, including in towns where students were prevented from attending all-white schools. She's also addressed disparities in Israel's juvenile justice system, where young Ethiopian Israelis are locked up at far higher rates than the Jewish population as a whole. When hundreds of Ethiopians took to the streets this past summer to protest police brutality, Tamanos Shatta says she was not surprised one bit. She says the problem has been simmering for a long time in Israel.
There is profiling against Ethiopians. We are the only black in this country, and it has put us in a very bad situation that our children feel that they suffer violence behavior from police.
Like most Ethiopians in Israel, Tamanos Shatta says she grew up in a family that always voted for Likud, the right-wing party of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But both she and Gadi Ivarkin joined the centrist Blue and White Party. And when all of the votes were counted in September, each candidate was high enough on the party list to make it into the Knesset again. Party leaders are in negotiations now about forming a governing coalition. If and when that coalition takes shape in the coming weeks, Ivarkin and Tamanos Shatta say they will get to work trying to fulfill the promises they've made to their supporters. For The World, Matthew Bell, Or Yehuda, Israel.
On Friday, we told you about long-distance runner Eliud Kipchoge from Kenya. He was preparing to do something that had never been done before, run a marathon in under 2 hours.
We have liftoff. Apollo Kipchoge is up and away.
That was Saturday in Vienna. 1 hour, 59 minutes, 40 seconds later.
Eliud Kipchoge storms into the history books in Vienna.
At the finish line, Kipchoge said he wanted his accomplishment to inspire people.
To tell people that no human is limited, you can do it.
Kipchoge's time has an asterisk on it, though. It won't be counted as an official marathon time. He was protected from wind and was assisted by a rotating team of pace setters. Another Kenyan runner did officially break a marathon record this weekend. Bridget Kosgei demolished the women's time in Chicago yesterday. She finished in just 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 4 seconds, shaving more than a minute from the previous record. And that gets us across the finish line on this Monday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.